This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you. From daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Survivor 48 is here. And after every episode, dig deep into the show with On Fire, the official Survivor podcast. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast with me, Jeff Probst, every Wednesday after the show, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you, Dave. Jam-packed 9 o'clock hour. We're going to talk about the 2025 report card on infrastructure for Louisiana. Louisiana got a D+. The last one was released in 2017. We'll see if things are going to be any better this time. We're going to talk with Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, about the passengers in the car that killed and hit that St. Tammany police officer, also being charged with first-degree murder. We'll break all of that down. And we're going to talk about the security breach with the text messages with a gentleman who's been on with us before from the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy, Javad Ali. And it was interesting to see the response. Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, denying it when they had already confirmed that it was, in fact, confidential information or security information or attack plans. The president saying that he didn't like Atlantic Magazine and he thought they were going to be out of business. And it just seems to me the easiest thing in the world would be to say, we made a mistake, we're going to tighten it up, or we're not going to do that again. But and also to attack the journalists that received the message inadvertently. You know, he was just sitting in a parking lot at the supermarket and got it. So we'll talk about all that. We begin with Tom Smith, Executive Director of the American Society of Civil Engineers, talk about this report card. How you doing, Tom? Tom?
Hi, this is Tom Smith. Greetings. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. It's Tommy Tucker from WWL. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm all right, sir. Thanks for taking the time with us. Let's start with, what is the American Society of Civil Engineers, ASCE?
Absolutely. American Society of Civil Engineers is a nonprofit organization of 160,000 members, and we've been around for over 170 years, and we advance the public health and safety and welfare by advancing civil engineering, and one of the things we do is build civilization and focus on infrastructure. So we do a report card on America's infrastructure, which I know is the subject of our discussion this morning.
Yeah, build civilization. I love the way you said that, and that's why I admire engineers, because especially civil engineers, well, I shouldn't say that, but nothing just happens, right? There has to be a lot of planning, and the same numbers that were used to build a bridge back in, I guess, the Egyptian times are the same numbers that are used today, right? Except maybe computed a little bit differently.
Yeah, we've come a long way since then, absolutely. But we have, we have a lot of infrastructure now that unfortunately is been designed and built by a prior generation. And so we have failed to operate and maintain it at the level that we need to. And that's one of the things that we do with our report card on America's infrastructure. For the last over 20 years, we've been evaluating the performance of our infrastructure to make sure that the public and lawmakers understand, what is the condition? What is the capacity? What kind of future needs do we have? Is it resilient? Is it safe? Is it innovative? And, you know, what kind of operation and maintenance needs we have?
So I got a lot of questions. First of all, let's go back to the report card for America's infrastructure. What are you looking at specifically? How are you measuring? How are you choosing what to look at? Is it based on age? Do you have a list? Take me through that.
Sure. Yeah, we have a team of over 50 people that are professional engineers and infrastructure experts that evaluate data. We look at 18 different categories of infrastructure. So, you know, it's obviously the things you initially think about, like roads and bridges, but it's aviation, it's broadband, it's drinking water, hazardous waste, inland waterways. You know, it ranges all the way up to schools and stormwater and transit. And so all these are things that, you know, we rely on for our quality of life and that are the foundation for our economy and make us globally competitive as a nation. So we look at each of those categories. We look at quite a bit of data, and then we have a methodology where we analyze it according to different criteria. So we're looking at what is its capacity, what kind of condition is it in, what are the funding levels associated with it, what is the future need, the operation and maintenance, public safety, resilience, and innovation. So we've been doing that with these criteria. We pour over a lot of data. We're engineers, so you know we love to look at data and analyze how it's performing and making sure that it's ready for the future. And so we've been doing this. So we first started doing it in 1998, and most recently are issuing our 2025 report card today.
Is this primarily about, I'm trying to think if it's about age or if it's about maintenance or if it's about improved materials or techniques that have happened since then or a little bit of each?
Yeah, it's a little bit of each. You know, when you talk about age, I mean, some infrastructure can perform. We've got, you know, you can find bridges that are, you know, multiple hundreds of years old. Mm-hmm. As long as you maintain it at the right level, you know, the age is not necessarily a factor. And of course, now we're designing our infrastructure oftentimes to be 75 or 100 years out. So we're trying to anticipate, you know, what kind of weather and climate conditions, you know, 100 years from now for our infrastructure's performance. So yes, it's we're looking at all of those things. Safety, we're looking at the funding levels, we're looking what do we anticipate for the future, we're looking at operation and maintenance, capacity. You know, oftentimes you'll find a bridge that was designed, you know, 50, 75 years ago, and its capacity now, it was designed for a capacity that might be half or less of what it's carrying today. So there's a lot of things that we're evaluating to make sure that our infrastructure is in satisfactory condition.
Just on a very micro level, and we're talking with Tom Smith, Executive Director of the American Society of Civil Engineers, ASCE. I'm sure you've seen that acronym somewhere. But on a micro level, as a homeowner, you tend to think that, and as a younger guy, I thought, okay, that's it. Scratch it off the list. It's done. No, it's not done. It constantly has to be maintained. And I think we as a people and sometimes as a nation don't realize that just because you build a bridge or just because you built a highway, that's not it. That it's not going to last forever, and you do have to maintain it. Do we have a problem with the mindset in this country, Tom?
Yeah, that's. I think you have a great example right there. You know, we cut a ribbon and feel like, okay, now it's done, and that's really just the beginning. A lot of the real costs are the operation and maintenance over many, many years, and whether it's a car or a house, as you referenced, or the human body. You've got to make sure that you are maintaining it. You don't want to have to go out and pay for it twice. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you fail, as an example with your, you know, a car or our home, if you don't maintain it, you're going to end up paying a lot more on the back end. And studies have shown that. We have, in terms of infrastructure, every dollar you invest today, it's going to save you up to $13 on the back end. So if we're proactive instead of reactive, we're actually going to save taxpayers far more money. And so we won't pay this hidden tax of poorly functioning, inefficient infrastructure.
You know, as I said that, I was in the automotive repair industry for a while I attended the University of Life, as I call it. And that's a tough business because nobody really wants to spend the money. They're no better off than they were perceptually than they were before whatever broke, right? So it's a miserable
exactly.
business to be in. Nobody's happy. And I suddenly realize as we talk here, that's kind of the same thing that's going on with asking the taxpayers for money to maintain this or that or the other thing, and you think, well, wait, why? We got a bridge. What do we need more money for? But you're about to tell us. Tell me about the grades the nation received and what areas need the most improvement.
Absolutely. So overall, the nation received a grade of C. So, you know, that's not something you'd be particularly proud to bring home on a report card. That's, you know, average. That's mediocre. It requires attention. You know, we know that leaves room for improvement. On the plus side, that is an improvement over the 2021 report card, which was a C minus. And I will tell you also that the 2021 report card was an improvement over the 2017 report card, which was a D plus. So in 2021, that was the first time we got out of the D range. So D meaning poor or at risk. So we're now in the C range, and that's good. And that's reflective of some investments that have been made in our infrastructure. You know, we've got the bipartisan infrastructure law, the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS and Science Act. Those things have provided federal investment that have been leveraged with state and local investment and private investment. So we're seeing, you know, investment in our infrastructure that is paying off. And these are incremental improvements. You know, that's taking us to a C. Obviously, we would love to be up at least at the B range, if not beyond. But, you know, this is something that we can celebrate as good progress. But I will say on the downside that of those 18 categories, you know, 9 of those are still in the D range. So that means poor at risk. So we certainly have room for improvement.
When it comes to categories, what are the areas that are more neglected than others?
Well, the lowest grades in the report card right now are stormwater and transit. And obviously, those are both important areas. Stormwater, of course, as we're seeing, you know, more extreme weather events, flooding events. That has certainly, you know about stormwater in New Orleans and of course, throughout the country. So those are particularly areas of concern, and that's a level D. So we have more, you know, impaired rivers, streams, you know, have gone from 424,000 miles impaired streams in 2010. That's gone up to over 700,000 miles in 2022. So that is an area that we think certainly needs attention. Transit is another one that's at a D. Now, the good side about transit is it used to be at a D minus. So we actually saw some improvement in transit. But it's got, you know, years of deferred maintenance. Again, like you were describing with cars, we have that same issue with transit and other elements of infrastructure.
Tell me about a new category for the 2025 report card.
Yeah, the new category was broadband. That got a grade of a C+, so it's a little bit better than the average grade for all of our other infrastructure. There are certainly areas on broadband that are, again, leave room for improvement, but this is the first time we've really been able to have a grade in that area because initially we had concerns about even having the amount of data that we needed to give it a grade. So we were able to give it a grade this year. We were pleased about that, so we're going to be able to track our progress on broadband in the future, but, you know, we still have 10% of our households without, you know, a broadband subscription.
Yeah, I was going to say that speaks volumes to what you're talking about here, because you're talking about upgrading or maintaining broadband, and there are areas that still don't have it. So while some people think, well, that's it, that's behind us, it's not, because it constantly has to be maintained. Accurate?
Exactly. Yep. It's just like everything. It's got to be maintained.
Else, yep.
And, you know, a lot of times, you know, when we cut a ribbon and it's all of a sudden after that, it's some of it also, by the way, is out of sight, out of mind. And it has to be operated and maintained at a high level. And that does require consistent and sustained investment. And we also have to really be thinking about, you know, the future, you know, where the puck is going and not just where it has been in the past. And a lot of our infrastructure was designed by a prior generation. It's 50, 75, even 100 years old or more. And so we've got to be sure to maintain it. And also, you know, sometimes we do have infrastructure that needs to be replaced.
I don't know how you sleep at night because, you know, as a homeowner that has done some repairs, once you open the walls up and you get involved with what can break back there or what can go wrong, it's hard to just see a house. You see what's behind the walls and you worry about what can break or what could go wrong. How do you live your life? You got to be looking at everything around you like that, huh, Tom?
Well, that's true. I mean, that's why the inspections are important in maintaining data, sensors, and we do analyze, you know, a lot of data as we're looking at our infrastructure, but also inspecting it on a regular basis. So it's something that has got to constantly be maintained. We need to make sure that we're continuing to draw attention to it, both with the public and with lawmakers. Again, when we fail to invest in infrastructure, we pay more on the back end. Every American family, you know, if we don't maintain the infrastructure that we have, we'll pay an additional $700, you know, if we don't maintain the bipartisan infrastructure law funding levels. Even with those funding levels, we actually compute a $2,000 hidden tax that we pay by failing to, you know, maintain the infrastructure at the level that we need to. Believe it or not, the number that is required to maintain it is about $3.7 trillion. The gap, that's the investment gap over the next 10 years. The good news is that that is money that comes from not just the federal government, but also from state and local and private sector. So it requires all hands on deck in a lot of different areas to maintain our infrastructure. We do know that when it disappears on us, when you don't have clean drinking water, when your transportation networks are shut down, or when you don't have energy, as we've seen in various places around the country where things have happened, we really appreciate infrastructure at that time. And what we want to make sure is that we don't have to do that on the back end, that we're proactive and not reactive.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate your time and your efforts. Tom Smith, Executive Director, American Society of Civil Engineers. We'll talk to Dane Cialino when we come back about the murder of that North Shore police officer. 923, Tommy Tucker, WWL. 929, things happen in life. You have a split second to make a decision. And as a result of a decision that Adrian Wattall, 17 years old, made, I'll say allegedly because he's just charged with it, Sergeant Grant Candy, St. Tammany Parish Sheriff's Officer, is dead. He leaves behind a wife and two children. And the driver of the vehicle, as well as two other 17-year-olds, have been charged with first-degree murder as a result of the death of this police officer. Dane Cialino, our friend, professor of law at Loyola, joins us now to talk about all of this. How you doing, Dane?
That's fine, Tommy. How are you?
I'm well, sir. You know, I said this, and it does all come down sometimes to one decision, huh? The police light you up and pull you over, and you got one decision to decide whether you're going to stop or not. And from there, events happen, and events and decisions have consequences. And these three 17-year-olds are certainly facing the consequences. Tell me what constitutes first-degree murder and the likelihood of conviction in this case, or at least as far as the legalities of it are concerned.
Well, a charge against the driver certainly makes perfect sense. The driver certainly knew that he was being pursued by the police, and likely when he saw the roadblock at the Oak Harbor exit for I-10 from I-10 in Slidell, he kept on going and ran over an officer. If the state contends that he had the specific intent to kill the officer, then that's enough to be first-degree murder, because you couple that specific intent with an aggravating circumstance that the victim, the intended victim, was a police officer. Mm-hmm. That's a classic case of first-degree murder in Louisiana. Now, I see that the sheriff's office has booked some of the passengers in the car with first-degree murder as well. And those charges are going to be much, much more difficult to prove, because simply riding along with someone who has the intent to kill doesn't make you an accomplice to first-degree murder unless you also share the intent to kill and do something to aid or and abet the killing, which is possible. I mean, it could be that somebody in the car was egging on the driver, like hit him, mm-hmm. Or something like that. But absent evidence like that, I don't think they're going to be able to sustain any first degree murder charges against the passenger. But as I said, the driver, that's a much easier case.
And this could be an attempt to try to get testimony from the other two passengers. Well, there are two passengers charged. There were additional two passengers as well, five people in a vehicle is total. How do you see this playing out, Dane?
Well, I don't think you kill a deputy in St. Tammany Parish and face anything less than a first degree murder mm-hmm. charge. Now, of course, first degree murder carries the possible death penalty. Whether they pursued death against the driver or not remains to be seen. But I certainly expect the grand jury to indict the driver for first-degree murder. As to the other passengers, I think it depends on how the evidence pans out about what they were doing in the car, what role they might have played in trying to aid or abet the killing of the police officer. But I wouldn't be surprised to see first-degree murder against the driver and perhaps even a decision to seek the death penalty.
17 years old has nothing to do with this at all, correct?
Well, I mean, he certainly can be charged as an adult for the first degree murder. It may be that there's a constitutional problem with seeking the death penalty against someone because they were 17 at the time of the perpetration of the offense. But you can bet that the St. Tammany's DA's office is going to push push this as to make it the most onerous charge they can possibly make it.
And absent death penalty, what's the punishment for first-degree murder?
Mandatory life in jail without the benefit of probation, parole, or suspension of sentence.
So it would be hard to believe, and again, nobody knows. We're speculating here. I would doubt that this would be something that anybody would want to plead out if you're the DA.
From
the driver's standpoint, at least.
Yeah, from the driver's standpoint, the only possibility would be some sort of manslaughter plea to get him a term of years, 40 years or something along those lines. But, again, given that a deputy was killed, I don't expect the DA's office to offer any mercy or quarter at all to the driver.
The only plea I could see would be take the death penalty off the table for a plea of guilty to first-degree murder, you think?
Or second-degree murder. Doesn't really make much difference. It's life is life, no matter whether it's for first-degree murder or second-degree murder.
Either way, it would be hard to believe, at least for me, that this 17-year-old, the driver at least, will not spend the rest of his life in jail.
I think that's highly likely at this point, yes.
Anything else, Dane, I'm missing you, my head?
No, sad case. Bad case, bad decisions, just like you said.
It really is. It's amazing. You got to be careful about who your kids hang out with as well. Thank you, sir. Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, and is so senseless is what the St. Tammany Parish Sheriff's Office says, and it's true. That's what Sheriff Randy Smith said. You got a 37-year-old deputy, Grand Candies, leaves behind a wife and two kids, and they have a GoFundMe page set up. You can find it at our website at WWL.com if you click on the story. Five youths, I guess I'll use a word, in the car. Three 17-year-olds arrested, charged with first-degree murder. I don't see there's any way, as Dane was just saying, that the driver of this vehicle doesn't go to jail for the rest of his life at a minimum. And I'm not saying that shouldn't happen. It just goes to show you that, man, you got a split second to make a decision. If you make the wrong one, it can go south very quickly for everybody. Quick break. We come back. We'll talk about the security breach that happened on Signal, this app, and how attack plans were accidentally texted to a reporter. We'll talk about that when we come back, 9:35, 25 till 10, traffic now, WWL. Eyebrow-raising security breach that happened with attack plans on the Houthi rebels. Javed Ali joins us, former senior director for counterterrorism on the National Security Council during the first Trump administration and an associate professor of practice at the University of Michigan's Ford School. Good morning, sir. How are you? Do you have me on mute, perhaps? Professor?
I do not. Do you hear me?
I can hear you now. Fine. Thank you, sir. For people that don't know, maybe if you could give me a brief synopsis of what happened with this, the attack plans being sent to a reporter.
So, Tommy, yeah, this is still an evolving story, but based on what is most recently coming out, it appears that in the aftermath of must have been a weeks-long deliberate planning process led by the National Security Council in the White House to consider what should the United States do against the threat from these Houthi rebels in Yemen, that at some point, sort of as a sidebar, I guess that's the best way I could describe it, this chat group was created by the National Security Advisor, Michael Waltz, or people around him, on the phones of all the senior folks who were involved in those National Security Council meetings inside the White House. And then it appears that there were these parallel conversations about issues related to, you know, what was being discussed in this highly classified forum inside the National Security Council. Then some of those discussions moved into the Signal chat on individuals' personal cell phones. So that's where things, to me, seem to have deviated or drifted from the formal planning process that was led by the White House, because the name of the group suggests that, because Michael Waltz or whoever created the group labeled it the Yemen EC, which stands for Principals Committee Small Group. So that right there tells me that there were a series of these meetings inside the White House that went all the way up to the Principals Committee, which Wallace would chair as a national security advisor, and then all the folks who are in that chat group were probably at the table in those White House meetings.
So this Atlantic reporter, and what bothers me, because everything's political, right, is that Hegseth first denied it, even though the White House said, yes, it does look legitimate. They attacked the reporter, whom, if anything, I think the reporter is to be commended because he sat on this. He didn't publish it because he knew it was of national security concern. The president himself attacked Atlantic magazine and said he didn't like it, that they were in trouble and the business was likely to fail. When in essence, this was a huge blunder that outlined an attack that could have put people in jeopardy. Is that accurate, Professor?
So another one of these really puzzling aspects of the series of events, and we've already talked about one, sort of this deviation from like the standard planning process that is tightly controlled and highly classified within the White House, and migrating over some of those discussions, migrating over into this Signal chat group. How in the world did somebody add a reporter to that chat group and nobody else in the group knew that that reporter was in there? I mean, that
was my question, Professor, is what in the hell, why in the hell, where, in what universe, what button do you press? How do you mistakenly put a reporter in attack plans for the U.S. military? I don't...
Yeah, I mean, again, that's why I keep using the word puzzling. I don't understand how, even if they wanted to keep this Signal group going, which they shouldn't have, but they did on their personal cell phones, then adding a reporter, and was that just a mistake, or was Goldberg, or were some of these folks previously a source for Goldberg, and that's why they added him? Like, I can't explain it other than just, you know, trying to grasp it. At some of these explanations, but then Goldberg sat in it in the chat group. No one knew that he was there, or sort of raised questions. Who is this person with the initials JG? Mm-hmm. And then he claims to have sort of seen these very sensitive operational details about the strikes that then happened on March 15th against the Houthis, and then there were follow-on strikes for the next couple of days. But at the flip side, on the flip side, Secretary of Defense Hegseth has denied that there were those details were in the chat group. I think the White House press secretary has also come out and said that there was no classified information. So now we've got a question of two sides telling two very different stories. And from the public side, I don't think we know all the facts or know where the truth is at this moment.
So this reporter would have had to have made this up if those are not accurate screenshots, right?
Well, again, I would have a hard time believing Jeffrey Goldberg would invent something that sort of striking in its revelation, because the other screenshots that he shared show some of the folks in this chat group and their reactions to the strikes and the aftermath of them occurring, and then some of the other discussions about sort of the policy dimensions of what would potentially happen. But we don't know yet if Goldberg will share what he saw, or whether he managed to also take screenshots or capture that information. But both the Secretary of Defense and the White House are pushing back on that. So, again, it's not clear where the truth lies, but I would have a hard time believing Goldberg would just make it up. Because, again, if he was making it up, then that would just do grave damage to the credibility of him as a journalist and to The Atlantic as an organization.
Why would they even be using Signal in the first place? And tell me about that app. I know it's encrypted, but, well, first of all, it could be as encrypted as you want. If you send it to the wrong person, then the cat is out of the bag. But what would be the proper way to do it? Tell me about Signal, and would this be some kind of way to keep it private and get around a public records request or something? I'm trying to understand the thought process behind all of this.
Right. So whether it's Signal or WhatsApp or other secure messaging applications that you can download for free onto your phone or your computer, they provide end-to-end encryption of the content of the communication. But again, if you created a group versus sort of a point-to-point conversation or discussion, well, now you potentially have increased the risk of other people knowing about your encrypted communications. And then, you know, the devices themselves could be compromised too. And with all these very senior U.S. government folks who are in the group, who knows, like Russia, China, other adversaries of the United States, have they been trying to gain some kind of electronic access to their personal cell phones? I don't know the answer to that. But again, like that's something you would have to consider from a risk perspective. But the fact that this signal group was created and then the conversations within the group, even if everyone thought they were encrypted and secure to people who were invited in it, were happening on their personal cell phones, that again is another issue, because even if they wanted to have these parallel conversations outside of the realm of the White House when they were having them physically inside the Situation Room, why wouldn't they have used their government-issued cell phones to have the same kind of group chat, which maybe they could have done that, maybe they couldn't have, but it seems like they were going for sort of expediency by having these conversations on Signal on their personal cell phone.
I know you...
Even if there's no classified communication, then it still seems like a breakdown in protocol.
I know you have to go. Politics aside, what do you want to see done? How do they fix this? Just make sure nothing like that ever happens again?
Yeah, well, hopefully there's some pretty clear guidance from the White House now coming out about these kind of conversations cannot happen on your personal cell phone anymore. If you're going to have them, they have to be inside a government facility, which the Situation Room is, and that's why you have the National Security Council meetings there, or you have to have them on your government-issued phones. But you can't do it on your personal phone, even if you're trying to use Signal or WhatsApp. And we'll see if that happens. Right now, also, President Trump has said, you know, he's not intent on removing or firing Mike Waltz. So it doesn't look like anyone is going to lose their job over this right now either.
Thank you, Professor. I know you got to go. Appreciate your time. Javed Ali, former senior director for counterterrorism National Security Council during the first Trump administration, an associate professor of practice at the University of Michigan's Ford School. The hardest thing in the world for some people to say is, oh, we goofed that up. We made a mistake. And as opposed to, you know, political sacrifices or this one getting fired or that, the other thing, I would just hope that, you know, forget Hillary Clinton, forget this, forget that. Let's move forward and just make sure that this never happens again and make sure that the proper protocols are being followed because you would think that, man, when it comes to something like this, it's done in a room with lead walls where nobody can hear what's going on or see what's going on, or some kind of satellite phone that's encrypted or something. This freaked me out when I heard about this yesterday. We'll take a break, find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.